July 2024, Primary. Hello and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding areas. This is the primary edition for the week ending Saturday, July the 6th, 2024. My name is Ian, I edit and produce this programme, and I hope you all had a very good June. I have to confess this edition of Primary is coming from my house on the island of Menorca in Spain, where the weather, I'm afraid to say, is fantastic. This edition of Primary will once again be distributed on USB sticks. Please remember to return them in the wallet provided when you have finished listening. Additionally, the programme is available on our website, sadtn.org.uk, under Listen Online. If you are using a mobile device, then it's available via the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. This can be downloaded free via iTunes or Google Play. Search for Talking Newspaper. Amongst other items, this edition has, as usual, on the USB stick distribution only, the BBC In Touch podcast. We'll also have the usual news roundup and the national radio listings. Once again, we'll be delving into the London Beyond Sight archives. This time, a description of the cranes at King's Cross by choreographer Siobhan Davis. There will also be the list of audio-described programmes on TV, courtesy of our friends at the Wharfdale Talking Newspaper. To finish, I'll be looking at past events and birth dates in the upcoming week. This week's music is Hotter Than Hot by local composer Goffby. First, let's move on to the news read by Christine, David, Deborah, Andy, Jane, and Keith.
This is Keith McDougall. School head delighted with good Ofsted. Verulam School has been rated good by Ofsted following its recent inspection. The Brampton Road School has recently had a change of head teacher, with Mr. Fergal Moan taking over at the beginning of May. Inspectors praised behaviour at the school, describing most pupils' behaviour as sensible, while also noting that those who do misbehave are dealt with firmly but fairly. The St Albans School's valuing of tradition and its house system were also praised. The report reads, "It provides good opportunities for sixth form students to show leadership and act as role models for younger pupils." It goes on to say, "Expectations are high for academic achievement. Pupils achieve well in the majority of curriculum subjects. The school provides very well for most aspects of pupils' wider development. The curriculum was described as well organised. However, the education watchdog did raise concerns about pupil assessments, noting that while a new system had been put in place since their last visit, that opportunities are still being missed. With regard to pupils with special educational needs, SEND, the feedback from Ofsted was mixed. Pupils with additional needs are clearly identified, but, the report says, while some teachers make adaptations and adjustments as required to help meet individual needs, this is not consistent. This occasionally slows learning for pupils with SEND because they struggle to complete their work. Having previously been an issue, the report notes that attendance is improving. Inspectors found that leaders have good knowledge of the reasons why pupils are absent and have a range of effective strategies to support them. The report also found the majority of staff working at the school enjoy working there and that pupil support is excellent. Commenting on the report, Mr. Moan said, "We are delighted that Ofsted has recognised the progress that Verulam has made since our last inspection. They've cited key strengths in line with our values, excellence in a broad curriculum with strong academic outcomes, character in praising our personal development programme as excellent, and respect in that our students are safe and happy in an inclusive environment where everyone can be themselves. We will continue to work with our community and partners in the Trust to strengthen further."
Hello, my name's Christine Stanley. Now, a well-known postman, affectionately known as Postie Mike, has cut the ribbon at a new £500,000 play area in Bricket Wood. Internet content creator Mike Izzard was on hand for the grand opening of the revamped Woodbury Field play area. New facilities unveiled include a Ninja Warrior course, ball games area, adult gym equipment, and a pump track for BMX bikes. The launch day saw visitors treated to live music, hot dogs, and an ice cream van. The upgrade comes after a cash injection from Lyndon Holmes and Crest Nicholson, which are both working on housing developments in the village. David Yates, chair of St Stephen Parish Council, said, "This is a tremendous achievement." A few years ago, people were commenting on Facebook that Woodbury Field was a depressing and boggy place to take your children to play. We had a fantastic response to our efforts to find out what people wanted to see here, and I hope we've met or exceeded people's expectations. As well as the contributions from Lyndon Home and Crest Nicholson, delivering this transformation has involved a great deal of work by the whole parish team, and I hope people will agree that it has been worth it. Verity McMahon, Managing Director of Vistry Central Home Counties, said, "As part of the planning agreement for Hanstead Park, Lyndon Homes has contributed £250,000 towards the provision of a host of new equipment at Woodbury Field Play Area, which is less than a mile away from our new development. It was great that so many villagers turned up for the official opening of the refurbished play area, and lovely to see the local Girl Guides group selling hot dogs to raise money for charity. All in all, it was a fantastic family-orientated event which brought the whole community together. The revamped play area is a wonderful new facility that can be enjoyed by children and adults alike. The £250,000 we paid towards the creation of this new play area was just part of almost £1.68 million in funding we have provided to help improve local services and facilities for the benefit of new residents and the wider community." And there's a lovely photograph of a crowd of people in the park, and Postie Mike and a lady and a gentleman are cutting a red tape with some enormous scissors. And there's another photograph of children playing on the slide and the swings, and a photograph of Postie Mike and two others eating ice creams.
Concerning levels of E. coli detected. E. coli levels 6 times higher than acceptable have been detected in the River Vere. The worrying revelation comes after research carried out by intrepid volunteers from the Vere Valley Society. They collected samples that have now been tested by scientists at London's Brunel University. The beleaguered river has had a difficult few years, with raw sewage being repeatedly dumped into the rare chalk stream, one of only around 200 in the world. Since March, sewage has been pumped into the Vere seemingly non-stop, with the amount recently surpassing 2,400 hours worth. The volunteers found around 3,000 E. coli colonies per 100 millilitres of water in the beloved chalk stream. The accepted threshold is 500 colonies. The Vere Valley Society Chair, John Pritchard, said, "It's extremely frustrating that the sewage has been pouring in for several months now, and there isn't really an immediate solution. It's a habitat that's very special to the community, and these spillages encourage the wrong sort of plants and can be detrimental to human health. Recently, a road in Flamstead River Hill was flooded with contaminated water, and motorists drove through it, in some cases spraying water over neighbouring hedges." The UK is currently facing a national E. coli crisis, with the UK Health Security Agency confirming on the 27th of June that one person has died after being infected with the bacteria. These latest developments come as part of an ongoing row over the fate of the Vere. Last month, protesters from across the city took part in a demonstration in London to call on the next government to protect the Vere, as well as England's other rivers and streams. The Environment Agency is currently undergoing an investigation, while Thames Water is yet to implement its groundwater impacted system management plan, with work delayed until 2025.
Businesses team up for a charity bike ride. Two London Coney businesses are hosting a virtual charity bike ride to raise money for genetic disease research. Specsavers and Pure Gym in London Coney Fields Shopping Park have teamed up to support CDG UK, which supports those affected by congenital disorders of glycosylation, that's CDG. The Specsavers team was approached by customer Ellie Daniel, her husband Steve, and their daughter Ruby, who lives with the condition. Ellie and Steve said there's no cure for CDG, not yet, but with raised awareness, we can help to fund research into cures and life-changing treatments for children like Ruby. Specsavers staff and members of the public started the challenge on Sunday, June the 30th, finishing on July the 7th. They are cycling the equivalent distance from the shopping park to Great Ormond Street Hospital, one of the charity's main institutes of research, on stationary bikes provided by Pure Gym. Donations can be made at www.justgiving.com page Philippa Aster or in person at the store with London Coney Sainsbury's or at Pure Gym. Specsavers store trainer and fundraiser organiser Philippa Aster said, "Make sure you come down to cheer your very own local businesses as we ride for Ruby this July." And there's a photograph of four people, three women and one man, wearing pale green t-shirts with a photograph of Ruby on the front and in pink lettering, big letters that say, "For Ruby." I'm wearing green for Ruby.
Hello. I'm Andy. The headline for this article is Primary School Rated Good After Ofsted Inspection. A Harpenden primary school has remained good after its latest Ofsted visit, but inspectors highlighted several areas that need improvement. Saunsey Wood Primary School has undergone significant change in the last year, with inspectors noting that these are having a positive impact on pupils. Despite this, inspectors highlighted concerns, particularly around behaviour, and intend to return in the next 2 years for a full re-inspection. The report begins by praising the high expectations the school has for its pupils, as well as breadth of opportunities offered in the form of trips and clubs. In terms of what the school does well, inspectors praised the curriculum for its wide-ranging nature, singling out the food room for praise. The personal development programme was praised, as was the strong link between school trips and the curriculum. However, they noted that in some areas the curriculum is not as well defined, with teachers struggling to know what to plan and teach. The report remarks that this is holding back pupil progress, but acknowledges that steps have begun to address this. The recently introduced behaviour policy has had mixed results, with teachers guilty of applying it inconsistently. Teachers do not all have the same high standards of behaviour, and inspectors found that this leads to learning being disrupted. The report says, "The school tracks behaviour incidents and attendance over time. However, this information is not used effectively to identify trends or evaluate the impact of the school's actions to improve these areas. When disruption to learning occurs, teachers do not always manage it well. A new phonics curriculum introduced last year has been poorly implemented, with the report blaming changes in staff and a lack of training. The school's provision for pupils with special educational needs was deemed adequate. Inspectors also found that recent changes in leadership have left staff feeling unsettled. Weaknesses in the curriculum and the approach to behaviour have added to staff workload. The report does note that staff are optimistic about recent changes.
Hello, I'm Jane Wilson, and my first article today is New Approach to 20-mile-an-hour Zones. Schemes could be revised for specific areas. Transport officials may now re-look at plans for 20-mile-an-hour zones that have not been supported by residents, where they believe a smaller scheme may be supported. The 20-mile-an-hour zones are widely seen as a way to support road safety, create calmer streets, and encourage more people to walk and cycle. In 2021-22, the County Council earmarked £7 million for the rollout of a number of schemes across Hertfordshire. At a meeting of the County Council's Highways and Transport Cabinet Panel last Tuesday, councillors heard that there are 39 schemes that are at various stages of delivery across the county. Of those, 6 have been completed, with a further 5 planned but yet to be implemented, and 7 at the detailed design stage. A further 11 schemes that have been assessed and scoped have not been progressed after failing to win local support at consultation. Now councillors have been told that a more flexible approach is to be adopted where schemes are not backed locally. Instead of not progressing with the schemes at all, they could seek to identify smaller scale interventions. That could, say officers, allow for more tailored interventions, focusing on areas with higher levels of vulnerable road users, such as around schools or other community areas. Going forward, it was reported that after the consultation stage, there would be 3 options available. There would be options to progress with the whole scheme or to withdraw from it entirely. There would also be an option to revise the project, identifying specific areas for smaller scale interventions, such as schools, parks or shopping areas. During the debate, Executive Member for Highways and Transport, Councillor Phil Bibby, stressed the commitment to public support when implementing a 20 miles an hour scheme. Obviously, we would have liked to have all the top prioritised schemes in place in their entirety, he said. But we very clearly set out, even though there was objection at the time, that we will work with member and public agreement because we are not going to impose these limits. In emphasising the council's decision not to impose 20 mile an hour limits, Councillor Bibby also pointed to the public backlash in Wales. We are only putting these schemes in where they are actually acceptable to the public, he said.
My name's Deborah, and my first piece is headed Family Pays Tribute to Cyclist Nigel. He touched the lives of so many people. The family of a St Albans man who was tragically killed in a crash in Bovingdon have paid tribute to the best husband and father we could ever imagine. Nigel Woodhead was cycling along Bovingdon Green at around 11 a.m. on Friday, May the 24th, when he was involved in a fatal collision. A tribute has now been released by his wife and daughters, who said, "Nigel was a deeply loved husband, father, brother, uncle, and friend to many. It is impossible to come to terms with the sudden and tragic loss of such a caring, selfless, and intelligent man, who was so full of life and excited about his future. We have been blown away by the outpouring of kind words about Nigel, who touched the lives of so many people with his wise words, attentive ears, and mischievous sense of humour. Cycling was one of Nigel's favourite pastimes, which had been a passion of his for decades. Just the week prior to his death, he was proud to have completed a solo cycle of the Pennine Cycleway, a 350-mile trip which he completed in 4 days. He was aspiring to complete a cycle from John O'Groats to Land's End in the not-so-distant future, which we are gutted he never got to achieve. However, Nigel's greatest passion was us, his family. He was the best husband and father we could ever imagine, and he devoted his life to providing for us. We were an inseparable family unit, with a bond that transcends life and death. Nigel, Dad, a life without you is unimaginable. If our love was enough to keep you here, you would have been here forever. Police are continuing to investigate the crash and have asked for anyone with information to report it at hearts.police.uk/report or by calling the non-emergency number 101 and quoting the reference number 41/41220/24. Nigel's family have asked for their privacy to be respected at this time, and there are two lovely photos of Nigel.
This article is headlined, New County Council Chief Executive Appointed. A new Chief Executive for Hertfordshire County Council was officially appointed last week. Angie Ridgewell was confirmed in the role by councillors at a meeting of HCC's full council last Tuesday. She will take up her new post from September. Scott Crudgington will remain interim Chief Executive until that time. The decision to appoint Angie follows the recommendation made by the Cross-Party Employment Committee last month after a competitive national recruitment and selection process. Angie will be joining from Lancashire County Council, where she has been Chief Executive since 2018. A qualified accountant by profession, Angie has worked in a wide range of public sector bodies, local authorities, and the private sector. Following her appointment, Angie Ridgewell said, "I'm delighted to be appointed as Hertfordshire County Council's new Chief Executive. At this critical time for public services, I'm excited by this new challenge to lead Hertfordshire and ensure that it thrives as the county of opportunity for all who live and work here. Hertfordshire has strong emotional draws for me as the place where I grew up. I look forward to reconnecting with the county, getting to know the residents, colleagues and partners, and making a positive difference when I take up my appointment."
Man arrested on suspicion of sexual assault at snooker club. A 36-year-old man has been arrested on suspicion of sexual assault following an incident at a St Albans snooker hall. It was reported that at around 5:20 a.m. on Sunday, June the 16th, a man inappropriately touched a woman at the Raging Bull Club in London Road. An altercation allegedly followed, with the man assaulting two people who tried to intervene, grabbing one woman by the throat and punching another. The suspect from St Albans was arrested at the scene on suspicion of sexual assault and assault, or ABH. He has been bailed with conditions while inquiries continue. Sergeant Lee Hammond said, "I'm appealing for any witnesses or anyone with information to get in touch by emailing me at lee.hammond@hearts.police.uk. When we arrived at the scene, the victim of the alleged sexual assault had already left the venue. We would like her to come forward so that we can help her and progress our inquiries. If this was you, please do not feel nervous about getting in contact. We take reports of this nature seriously and will do all we can to support you. You can report information online at hearts.police.uk/report, speak to an operator in the Force Communications Room via their online web chat at hearts.police.uk/contact, or call the non-emergency number 101, quoting crime reference 41/48378/24.
Technology for memory loss. St Albans mathematician Gareth Rowlands on how technology like an Alexa can be used to help tackle memory loss, along with using diaries and calendars. I was shocked recently when I saw the latest statistics issued by the Alzheimer's Society, indicating that there is a growing and alarming number of people now living with memory loss. The number of people living with dementia is predicted to rise to over 1.1 million by 2030, and one in three people will develop dementia in their lifetime. I believe we must constantly look at new ways to fight and tackle the scourge of memory loss. There are various ways of fighting memory loss, and when I visit care homes and memory cafes, I am repeatedly told that attempting my neurobic exercises and keeping their brains active is not only so much fun, but also helps to increase memory retention and fight memory loss. Keeping the brain active is an important part in fighting forgetfulness. Looking around care homes and everywhere I go, I notice different aids being used by people to help to keep different parts of the body functioning as they age. For example, people use walking sticks and Zimmer frames and crutches to help with mobility, spectacles and magnifying glasses to read and see things better, and hearing aids to hear better. Similarly, diaries, calendars, and notebooks can be very useful items for storing information and supporting the brain. I was also reminded how important keeping records can be, especially for keeping medical appointments and taking essential medication. And there are also personal dates, such as birthdays, anniversaries, and other celebrations. However, a question that came to my mind recently was, can modern technology devices be used and adapted to assist people needing help to remember day-to-day tasks? On a recent visit to a friend's house, I came across a voice-activated assistant called Alexa that uses artificial intelligence to respond to various commands. Once set up, I saw that the device could be operated without having to get up and push buttons or learn complicated programming sequences to use it. I immediately saw that there are benefits for people with memory loss and that the device can be useful in setting alarms and reminders throughout the day, enabling one to stay on top of important schedules and appointments, including recurring reminders for doing certain chores and personal care tasks, such as taking medication. I also saw that the device can create lists, such as shopping lists, on a smartphone. I was amazed how the device controlled certain smart home appliances, such as doorbell cameras, security cameras, TV program selections, voice control, and thermostat adjustments. I have often seen how some of our elderly living with memory loss struggle, and how it impacts on their day-to-day activities, including tasks that were once familiar. I can see how the device Alexa can be really useful, especially during the early stages of memory loss, where people can still live alone with some support and supervision. By programming the device with routines and teaching users how to use the device properly, the elderly can retain some of their independence, which may help them to adjust somewhat to living with memory loss. I can also see the potential for programming reminders for meals, medication, appointments, and many other tasks to manage a loved one's care schedule from a distance. Keeping a diary, filling in a calendar, or asking Alexa for help could certainly improve the quality of life of people already stressed by the onset of memory loss.
Highways washing their hands over dangerous roundabout markings. Highway bosses at County Hall have done nothing to tackle dangerously worn road markings at London Colney Roundabout almost a year after they were first reported. Local resident Gary Broadbent told Hertfordshire County Council on August the 2nd, 2023, "The lane marking lines on the London Colney roundabout have been almost invisible for a long time. It's an unusual lane layout, and without clear lane markings, many who are unfamiliar with it stray across the lanes, particularly when coming from the Hatfield direction and heading round the roundabout towards Park Street. I've seen several accidents there and almost been hit several times by drivers who obviously don't know the layout and can't see it because the lines are almost non-existent. It's one of the most dangerous bits of road in the area. And fixing it would be relatively cheap, just repaint the lines. But there seems to be no action. It's going to get much busier soon once construction of the rail freight terminal gets underway. Work has now commenced on the rail freight terminal, and yet still highways have not tackled Gary's concerns. A customer interaction officer told him this week, "I can confirm that London Colney Roundabout was identified last year as a hazardous site. However, we did not investigate further due to changes to the A414 corridor as part of the Radlett Freight Interchange development. I'm told that the improvements will include road marking changes and resurfacing works, which will hopefully help alleviate issues. We hope that the works will be undertaken towards the end part of 2025. Regarding your comments about the cost of repainting lines, we must also take into consideration the cost in closing off the road to carry out the remarking safely. The cost of traffic management, where we must reduce all entries onto the roundabout down to one lane, and various lane switches to address the lining on both lanes of the roundabout, comes at a huge cost. I've been advised that if any works are being undertaken in this location that require a road closure, we will do our best to raise works to remark the roundabout in order to maximise the closure, reduce disruption and help with cost." Gary responded, "I am aware of the roundabout upgrades as part of the Radlett Freight Interchange. The road markings on the roundabout were worn out long before I reported them and well before Hertfordshire County Council sold the land to Sergro for the Radlett Freight Interchange. But even then, they did nothing. I have been mentioning this lack of action on the Hertfordshire County Council's social media posts for several years. Saying that we will have to wait another year and a half for work to start is ridiculous. There are virtually no road markings left now. How bad will they be in 18 months' time? And that assumes that work there actually starts on schedule. Most of the other work is well behind schedule, and Sergro will prioritise work that gets the Radlett Freight Interchange up and running, not ancillary works that don't really benefit them. In addition, much of the construction traffic to build the Radlett Freight Interchange will use that roundabout. This will be heavily laden HGVs with drivers who probably don't know the area. This is a recipe for even more crashes, possibly more serious. I have witnessed several myself, and I'm not even a regular user. For Hertfordshire County Council to say that they will do nothing at this stage is irresponsible and dangerous."
Support our small businesses this Independence Day. St Albans BID is supporting Independence Day UK by encouraging shoppers to make an extra effort to support small and shop local in July. Independence Day UK is a year-round campaign dedicated to supporting and promoting independent retail businesses throughout the UK. Each year it culminates in a special focus around July the 4th, with this year's campaign extending over the weekend of Saturday and Sunday, July the 6th, 7th. Emma Bustamante, owner of Cositas on Hollywell Hill, said, "We're lucky enough here in St Albans to have a lovely collection of independent retailers. It really helps us to stand out as a city, with many visitors from out of town commenting on it positively when I'm chatting to them in the shop. All us hard-working business owners are nothing without customers, though, and that means we rely on the support of our local community. The High Street is a tough place to be at the moment, and Independence Day is a great reminder to celebrate, appreciate and buy from your favourite indies who help to make our city so great." Eddie James, assistant manager at Empire Records in Heritage Close, said, "Independent businesses are important in St Albans or any town or city, as they help it to maintain its own identity and character. People visiting St Albans do so for the history, the architecture and green spaces, and often part of that overall experience includes shopping. As a tourist city, we need independent businesses to help us stay unique and relevant to all, visitors and residents alike. Long live the Indies!" Terry Harrington, retail director of Raindrops on Roses on High Street, added, "One of the biggest advantages of being an independent retailer is that we can sell and promote the products that some of the amazing local artists and craftspeople design and create, from candles and toiletries to original paintings and jewellery. It gives up-and-coming talented local people an opportunity to get their name out there, whilst we, Raindrops on Roses, can donate all our profits to our chosen charity, Action Against Cancer." Bind manager Vivian Cannon is encouraging people to support the initiative. The recent economic turmoil has had an immense impact on small businesses. Independents are essential to our city centre. As well as offering individuality and a personal service, they create jobs and support the local economy. We encourage shoppers to head out and support our independents, not just for July, but all year round.
The headline for this article is Historic Beer Making Revival, and a subheading, St Albans beer columnist Roger Protts on how a unique and historic beer making method has been saved and is making a comeback. A unique and historic method of beer making that seemed destined for the scrapyard has been saved and is making superb India Pale Ales in the Derbyshire Peak District. The method is known as the Burton Unions, and it takes its name from the famous brewing town of Burton-on-Trent in Staffordshire. In the mid-19th century, commercial glassmaking meant pewter tankards were replaced by glass containers in pubs. Drinkers could see what was in their glasses, and they were less than impressed with murky and yeasty beer. A number of major brewers, including Mann's and Truman's in London and Boddington's from Manchester, had opened second sites in Burton to use the mineral-rich waters of the Trent Valley to make the new and fashionable pale ales. They were desperate to produce clear and sparkling beers, and they were aided by a brewer called Peter Walker from Warrington, who had also opened a second site in Burton. He took out a patent on a system he developed that involved beer fermenting in large oak casks that were linked together, or as Victorians said, held in union, by pipes and troughs. The force of fermentation drives fermenting beer and yeast up swan-necked pipes into troughs above. The troughs are held at a slight incline, allowing the beer to return to the casks via more pipes, while the yeast is retained and used in further brews. The finished beer is clear of yeast and is the sparkling pale ale demanded by drinkers. The system was adopted by other brewers in Burton and spread to brewing centres in both this country and as far afield as Australia. The system is expensive to maintain. Resident coopers have to build and repair the casks, which have to be regularly cleaned and scraped to remove dead yeast cells and protein. One by one, brewers abandoned the system until only Marston's in Burton was still using it to make its famous Pedigree Pale Ale. In 2022, it merged with Carlsberg to form the Carlsberg Marston's Brewing Company, with the Danish brewer controlling 60% of the business. Since then, CMBC has gone on the rampage, closing Marston's subsidiaries Jennings, Ringwood and Wychwood, and announcing in January that it would ditch the Burton Unions on the grounds of costs. Riding to the rescue was Garrett Oliver, the celebrated brewmaster at Brooklyn Brewery in New York City. He's a frequent visitor to this country. He's seen the Burton Unions in operation at Marston's, and he has made beers at Thornbridge in Bakewell. He spoke to CMBC with the result that the group agreed to donate one union set to Thornbridge. I went to see it at close hand as a new beer, Union IPA, was going through the system. The Thornbridge team, led by head brewer Rob Lovett, has also made a batch of its main beer, Jaipur IPA, using the Union. I was able to taste samples of Jaipur brewed in the conventional manner and also using the Union, and it was fascinating to find that the Union brew was softer, rounder and less bitter than the conventional beer. Jaipur IPA is widely available in both cask and bottled form. When Union IPA is ready to go on sale after brewing and conditioning, I'll let readers know where it's available. The last word goes to Garrett Oliver, who's been to see the Union set in operation at Thornbridge. It's a beautiful beast. It also makes a particularly nice Jaipur, he says.
And now an article from the St Albans Times. St Albans Jewellers double win at Industry Oscars. Harriet Kelsall, Bespoke Jewellery, which has a design studio and showroom in St Albans, has won two awards in the Retail Jewellers UK Jewellery Awards 2024. They accepted the accolades for Bespoke Jewellery Retailer of the Year and Ethical Sustainable Jewellery Business of the Year. Branded the Oscars of the jewellery industry, Harriet Kelsall, Bespoke Jewellery's double win, was highlighted as a phenomenal demonstration of their design expertise, exceptional craftsmanship, and forward-thinking ethical and sustainable efforts. The judges remarked, "They are outstanding winners, heads and shoulders above the rest, with an absolute focus on bespoke commissions. Our judges were unanimous that they live and breathe ethical and sustainable principles. Harriet Kelsall Bespoke Jewellery is the real deal." Harriet said, "To win two national awards is amazing. It's also a huge compliment to hear we were clear winners in both categories. The competition in both areas can seem steep. We're proud to be the UK's leading bespoke jeweller and to now be thoroughly recognised in these important areas within our industry." Harriet Kelsall Bespoke Jewellery trailblazed the bespoke jewellery on the high street concept over 25 years ago and have gone from strength to strength. Across their four studios and shops, their expert designers and on-site goldsmiths celebrate every person's individuality. Their innovation tells unique stories through exceptional pieces of jewellery, where positive ethical choices are always at the core of their values. Their bespoke service goes beyond receiving jewellery. It's a collaborative and memorable experience for every customer.
Hello, David Eisen here with some more stories from this week's Hearts Advertiser. Songs at Abbey for Hospice. The Sounds Around the Abbey musical spectacular will take place on three consecutive evenings in July to raise money for Rennie Grove Peace Hospice. The three-day Sounds Around the Abbey musical spectacular in aid of Rennie Grove Peace Hospice care will return to St Albans this July. The performances that take place on three consecutive evenings from Thursday, July the 25th to Saturday, July the 27th will once again bring a mix of rock, pop and West End classics to St Albans Cathedral. Now in its fifth year, the musical spectacular will raise funds to add to the £115,000 already raised over the years to provide vital hospice care in the area. The shows, directed by Pippa D. Collins and hosted by Rosemary Ford, will bring music fans a variety of well-known as well as some less well-known songs, spanning an eclectic mix of musical genre. The programme will include performances from the Brilliant Theatre Academy of Performing Arts, all three nights, the Jupiter Singers, Thursday, July the 25th and Friday, July the 26th, and the London Show Choir, Saturday, July the 27th, all accompanied by a live band led by musical director Matt Pallant. At each of the shows, the West End stars Hugh Maynard, The Lion King, Miss Saigon, Sweeney Todd, and Amy Atkinson, Six, Pretty Woman, will be performing hits from popular shows. Chris Langford is the Rennie Grove Peace Vice President and the driving force behind the concerts. He says, "Sounds Around the Abbey has become a real staple in the local social calendar and is a unique opportunity to experience West End stars performing alongside local adult and youth choirs in the iconic surroundings of St Albans Abbey. We are looking forward to another exciting, happy and successful event that will help to raise vital funds for Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care." Gemma Ralph, Community Fundraising Manager at Rennie Grove Peace Hospice Care, adds, "Sounds Around the Abbey is a wonderful community event that wouldn't be possible without the dedication of Chris and Pippa, who organised the concerts, and our event sponsors, MK Ginder and Sons and Origin. I'd like to thank them all for their time, energy and commitment in raising funds to provide much-needed hospice care in the local area. Tickets for the shows are priced at £22.50, £35 or £40 and are available via the St Albans Cathedral website. To find out more about the event, visit renniegrovepeace.org/whatson.
Firefighters cycle to every Hertfordshire fire station for injured colleague. A group of 22 firefighters undertook a mammoth challenge on Sunday, cycling to every fire station in Hertfordshire in a bid to raise money for an injured colleague. Starting at 5 a.m, the group cycled 180 miles in 16 hours, visiting all 29 stations across Hertfordshire. While the annual bike ride, known as the Ride Around Herts, is now in its seventh year, 2024 had a special significance as riders were raising money to support an injured colleague. Liam Coffill was involved in a collision with a van last August while cycling to work. He suffered a severed spinal cord and is dealing with life-changing injuries. The riders were raising money for the firefighters' charity, which is currently supporting Liam. Liam joined part of the challenge, riding an adaptive bike featuring a reclined seating position with hand pedalling. Watch commander Dwight Williams, who helped to organise the challenge, said, "Having Liam join us for part of the bike ride was very special. He's an inspiration to us all. Whilst we may have sore muscles after the challenge, it's humbling to see how he's handling the changes to his life following the accident." Riders were cheered on by a gathering crowd as they completed their mission, and the day has so far raised nearly £5,000, double the original target.
Star of Netflix hit One Day is special guest at Harpenden School. Harpenden's Katherine Warrington School welcomed actor Johnny Weldon as the keynote speaker for their second annual Arts Awards evening. Johnny, who played Ian in the hit series One Day, delivered an inspiring and entertaining speech that resonated with students, parents and arts enthusiasts alike. He said, "Having loved the arts from a young age and started off working in school productions, it's such an incredible privilege to come and see a school that supports and champions the arts as much as Katherine Warrington School and gives its young people such incredible opportunities." In addition to Johnny's keynote address, the evening featured performances by students from the choir, orchestra and dance company, and the presentation of awards by Johnny and Sarah Graham, a celebrated photorealist painter and Katherine Warrington School's new patron of the visual arts.
Explore life in Roman Britain, Verulamium. Families can enjoy a packed programme of activities at Verulamium Museum in St Albans this summer. From July the 24th to August the 31st, daily activities will take place at the museum, included with the price of admission. Children can dress up to imagine living in Roman Verulamium and explore the museum with an artefact handling trolley and explorer buckets. They can have a go at arch building and mosaics to imagine being a Roman craft worker. And for £2 per activity, children can create something to take home in summer crafts at the colonnade. Archaeology for Families runs from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on July the 24th and 25th and is suitable for children ages 7 to 12. learn how archaeologists record what they find in the ground, analyse genuine finds, or join a blanket dig. Visitors can meet Tessa Wheeler, who was a key figure in unearthing the Roman town of Verulamium in the 1930s. Tessa will talk about her archaeological work excavating the site at 10:45 a.m. on July the 24th and August the 1st, free with admission. Tots Tales sessions for children ages 2 to 4 and their grown-ups will be held from 10:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1:15 p.m. and 2:15 p.m. on July the 26th and August the 30th. July's story is The Cook and the King by Julia Donaldson and David Roberts. Mosaic making workshops for ages 5 plus will be held on July the 30th and August the 29th. And Roman oil lamp making workshops for ages 7 plus will take place on July the 31st, with participants able to take their creations home. Family painting workshops for ages 4 plus will take place on August the 7th and 21st. Children aged 7 plus can make a Roman game in a workshop on August the 14th or a Roman mask on August the 28th. Roman farmer Laurentius Calvus will share his stories of life in Roman Britain and his time in the Roman army at 1 p.m. on August the 8th, 15th and 22nd. The talks are free with admission. Finally, older children can take part in the war game The Romans Are Coming, rolling the dice to control Roman and ancient Britain soldiers as they fight over a village of roundhouses and a Roman villa. The all-day drop-in event takes place on August the 24th.
This headline is Blue Badges Seized in Anti-Fraud Operation. 20 blue badge parking permits have been seized following an operation by Hertfordshire County Council's Shared Anti-Fraud Service. The proactive scheme was carried out alongside partners from Oxfordshire County and Buckinghamshire Councils. Following a warning from police in the area that blue badge theft is on the rise, SAFS officers worked with officers and civil enforcement officers between June the 11th and 21st to patrol various locations across the counties. In Hertfordshire, 76 blue badges were inspected and 6 of these were seized across Broxbourne, Stevenage, Wellin Hatfield, East Harts, North Harts and Hartsmere. 4 of those seized were out of date and 2 were being used by someone other than the named registered user. A further 5 will now be subject to further inquiries due to 1 being identified as stolen, 2 being used by a non-registered user, and 2 being used while out of date. The officers on patrol also issued leaflets to members of the public to raise awareness of the correct ways to use and display a blue badge, along with additional safety information to prevent genuine users becoming victims of blue badge theft. Since the start of 2022, the Shared Anti-Fraud Service has received 421 referrals of suspected blue badge fraud, leading to 130 warning letters being sent to permit holders.
TEDx, set to return to St Albans later this year. TEDx is making a return to St Albans later this year, with speakers announced and tickets on sale. Taking place at the Abbey Theatre on Wednesday, October the 16th, 2024's theme of curiosity is set to inspire talk-goers. Among those speaking at the event will be James Whittle and Tom Caulfield from The Tempest 2, who in 2015 decided to row 3,000 miles across the Atlantic Ocean with no previous experience. Rachel Oxborough, an art psychotherapist, will also be giving a talk. Cheryl Luzet, TEDx St Albans co-organiser and Wagada Digital CEO, said, "We are excited to bring TEDx to St Albans, a vibrant city which is the home to many great minds and inspirational leaders, in what is a very accessible format of delivering talks and sparking debate that everyone can get involved in. We hope to embed this event into the St Albans calendar of yearly events to nurture and inspire local talent. Fellow co-organiser Amy Burnett added, TEDx is all about ideas, community and impact, all things which I believe the population of St Albans feels passionately about. I'm really excited that we're able to bring this event to the city, and I'm looking forward to our community working together to make it an amazing day.
Chance to check out the playwrights of tomorrow at New Writing Festival. The Company of Ten is putting the finishing touches to their two-week-long one-act Feast of a Playwriting Festival, which will be showing in the Abbey Theatre Studio between July the 3rd and the 13th. Company of Ten received a bumper crop of exciting brand new scripts, which subsequently underwent rigorous assessment by their hard-working team of readers in order to select the very best to include in the festival. But it's not all about the playwrights. The aim was to include as many creatives in the project as possible, and with this in mind, the company is welcoming both current and new directors, technicians and actors to bring the scripts to life on the stage. Jenny Kilcast, who is running the festival, said, "It's been more than a year in the planning, and the logistics have at times been a bit of a roller coaster, but I'm delighted to be bringing the work of so many talented writers to the Abbey Theatre studio. Everyone involved has worked so hard to get this off the ground, and I hope the shows will get the audiences they deserve." As well as an opportunity to see some brand new original plays, audiences are also getting the opportunity to ask questions and give feedback at the end of the evening, and that input can be incredibly valuable to the writers, so don't miss out. Writer Mark Harris explained what his play is about. Cliff on the Edge is a three-hander comedy about coastal erosion and environmental issues, which relies on sound effects to enhance the production and to build the suspense towards the surprise ending. "I'm very excited and pleased to be involved because the new writing festival provides an opportunity to present my work to an audience and to see it brought to life for the first time to a very high standard of acting and production, while highlighting important and relevant topics, but in an entertaining way, which I hope will make the audience think, plus the chance to get feedback from the audience afterwards, which will be something to look forward to." St Albans Times theatre reviewer Deborah Heath also has a play in the festival. Gnome Anne's Land is a workplace comedy about a group of garden gnomes who are mysteriously disappearing. "I was inspired by a local St Albans garden and their well-known collection of garden ornaments, so it's really exciting that it's going to be staged in our fair city." The play has since been picked up by the Bite Size Plays to be part of their Edinburgh Fringe breakfast show. However, it was Company of Ten who noticed it first, for which I will always be grateful. I can't wait to see what the marvellous Company of Teens do with the play. With a possible three plays each night on offer to audiences for just £5 a ticket, they will have a wide range of genre and storylines to enjoy. They will also have the chance to comment constructively on what they have seen in order to help the playwrights further nurture their scripts. And who knows, you may be witnessing the first steps on the career ladder of the next Mike Bartlett or Lucy Prebble.
St Albans hosting Sixes Volleyball Tournament in Verulamium Park. The new operators of Verulamium Park's volleyball courts are kicking off the UK's only 6v6 beach volleyball tournament in a four-tournament series with a £1,000 cash prize. Deep Dish launched the first ever Sixes tournament last year in Sandbanks, Bournemouth, which saw 50 teams battle it out in men's, women's and mixed divisions. This year they will be hosting three mixed division Sixes tournaments throughout the summer, one at each of their clubs, Crystal Palace, St Albans and Bournemouth. The winner of each Sixes will get invited to the Sixes Finals in Bournemouth, which will take place at the UK Beach Tour Grand Slam Finals. The Sixes are open to any and all levels of play, with teams bringing players from beginners to advanced, and are aimed at bringing the indoor and beach volleyball communities together in a fun-filled tournament, with fancy dress highly encouraged.
And now the list of deaths as published in this week's Hertfordshire Advertiser.
Morris Edward Kane. Molly Bridget Francis, 88. Jessica Gibling, 38. Jean Morgan, 92.
A little more music now, followed by Gilly reading the national radio listings.
Hello, this is Gilly with this week's radio listings. After weeks of political broadcasts, we can now take a breath and listen to the radio for pleasure and entertainment. Hope this selection gives you both. Here are the programmes serialised through the week from Monday to Friday. Book of the Week, The Third Information Crisis. After writing and printing, the third crisis is digital communication. 11:45 a.m. on Radio 4 and repeated at 12:30 p.m. 10-second showdown, stories from the Olympics, 1:45 p.m. on Radio 4. Composer of the week is Thomas Linley Jr., 4 p.m. on Radio 3. Relaxed Evenings with Zeb Soames, 7 p.m. Classic FM, Sunday to Thursday. Book at Bedtime, Glorious Exploits, Episode 6 out of 10. 10:45 p.m. Radio 4. Now, choices from Saturday to Friday. Saturday, Music Matters, Music on the Front Line with Clive Myrie, 1 p.m. on Radio 3. Drama, The Great Cricket Con. An Indian village staged a fake cricket tournament to scam Russian gamblers. 3:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Opera on 3. The Coronation of Poppaea from Barcelona. 6 p.m. Radio 3. Archive on 4, Dirty Old Town at 75, a celebration of the classic folk song, 8 p.m. on Radio 4. And a comedy double, The Men from the Ministry, 8 p.m. on Radio 4, is followed by The Morecambe and Wise Show, 8:30 p.m. Radio 4 Extra. Symphony of Science with Brian Cox, a look at scientists who played music and composers who enjoyed science. 9 p.m. Classic FM. On to Sunday. Drama, A Vindication of Frankenstein's Monster. One of three is at 3 p.m. Radio 4. The Verb, presented from the Hay Festival by Ian McMillan. It's at 5:10 p.m. Radio 4. Drama, The Confession by Jesse Burton. 6:30 p.m. Radio 4 Extra. The Paul Gambaccini Collection is at 8 p.m. on Radio 2. Drama on 3. Beowulf Retold. 8 p.m. Radio 3. Monday now. And Natalie Haynes stands up for the classics. Cleopatra. 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4. Fags, Mags and Bags is a comedy set in a corner shop, 2:15 p.m. Radio 4. Mixed Messages, Crime Story, 5 p.m. Radio 4 Extra. Mark Steele's in Town, Stoke-on-Trent, 6:30 p.m. Radio 4. Hidden Treasures, throughout the week there will be these recently discovered treasures, Kind Hearts and Coronets, 8:30 p.m. Radio 4 Extra. As always, The Blues Show is with Keris Matthews at 9 p.m. Radio 2. To end Monday, History's Secret Heroes, The Extraordinary Cook Sisters, 9 p.m. Radio 4. Tuesday now. The Radio 4 drama is Faith, Hope and Glory. It's a new series. 2:15 p.m. Radio 4. Hidden Treasures, The Go-Between, 2:30 p.m. Radio 4 Extra and at 8:30 p.m. Beyond Belief, Why We Walk, 3:30 p.m. Radio 4. Joe Lycett's Obsessions. Guests reveal their secret obsessions at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4. Radio 3 in Concert on this day features works by Sibelius and Bruckner, 7:30 p.m. Radio 3. Peter White hosts In Touch, the programme for visually impaired people, 8:40 p.m. on Radio 4. And the Jazz Show with Jamie Cullum is at 9 p.m. on Radio 2. On to Wednesday. Boswell's Lives, Time Travel Comedy, 1 p.m. Radio 4 Extra. The drama is Faith, Hope and Glory, 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Hidden Treasures, The House on the Strand, 2:30 p.m. Radio 4 Extra and repeated at 8:30 p.m. Jeff Norcott's Working Men's Club, Comedy Examining Modern Masculinity, 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4. Radio 3 in Concert features works by Vaughan Williams. It's at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. And of course The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe is 9 p.m. on Radio 2. Thursday, The Infinite Monkey Cage, The Wonder of Trees, 11 a.m. Radio 4. Drama, Faith, Hope and Charity, 2:15 p.m. Radio 4. Hidden Treasures, The Philanthropist, 2:30 p.m. Radio 4 Extra, repeated at 8:30 p.m. Ramblings, Donegal with Ian Miller and Claire Balding, 3 p.m. Radio 4. Research, Does Education Work with Rhys James, 6:30 p.m. Radio 4. And Bob Harris with The Country Show is at 9 p.m. on Radio 2. If you're after music for late night listening, then try Night Tracks, 10 p.m. on Radio 3. Finally, Friday, the drama on Radio 4 is The Skies Are Watching, 2:15 p.m. Radio 4. Hidden Treasures, The Trouble with Lichen, 2:30 p.m. Radio 4 Extra, repeated at 8:30 p.m. The News Quiz, Topical Comedy, 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4. Friday night is Music Night, a concert on the theme of travel, 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. Any questions? Should be interesting after last week's election. It's at 8 p.m. on Radio 4. Thanks to Angela for compiling this list. Happy listening.
Thanks very much, Julie. Now, another from our series, London Beyond Sight. This is one of the many items that can be found on the Vocalise website. This time, choreographer Siobhan Davis describes the cranes at King's Cross.
My name is Siobhan Davis and I'm a choreographer. I enjoy the walk along the Regent's Canal. I enter the towpath at Camden Town and think my thoughts as I go towards King's Cross. As I turn a bend, I raise my eyes because I know that I will see the top half of a group of tower cranes which are being used to raise a new building. There are five of them, painted different colours, dark green and red, denoting the different construction companies they belong to. These cranes are at least 330 foot high and stand free of the buildings they are working on. I leave the canal and walk down King's Boulevard towards King's Cross Station. I have to tilt my head further and further back in order to keep seeing the tops of the cranes. They look like a collection of boat masts in a harbour. They also share with boats a structure of rigging. Cables make diagonal lines between the ends of mast and jib to connect them. Cables, which instead of helping to harness the wind in the sails, are used to manipulate the heft of building materials and manoeuvre them with considered delicacy to a precise place on the building site. The mast, unlike the solidity of the mast of a boat, is an open latticed column, a structure of steel struts, welded in zigzag triangles. The triangle is the strongest shape in engineering, so despite its skeletal appearance, the mast is sturdy as well as flexible enough to deal with the tension and weight it has to deal with. All the way up inside the mast are horizontal mesh platforms at regular intervals, with a connecting ladder for people to climb or descend. The size of the ladder seems deceptively small against the hugeness of this machine. On top of this part of the mast is a solid disc like a turntable, the slewing rig, which enables the entire upper section of the crane to swivel round 360 degrees in either direction. This upper section is the working arm, called the jib, which can be raised and lowered by the cables and turned by the disc, giving it a range of moves, including beautiful arcs, as the heavy materials both rise up and travel along to the exact places they are needed in. These arcs are both graceful and efficient, and are one of the main reasons I'm glued to watching this manoeuvre. I am feeling the move with them. The jib is latticed, like the mast. It can lower from its more stable position close to the mast and hover horizontally over the ground. Its furthest tip seems outrageously distant from its centre of balance, the main mast. From this tip is the U-shaped hook from which the load can be suspended. The two other parts of the crane above the slewing rig, the disc, are the A-frame, or machinery arm, whose wedge shape houses the motors. Beneath that is the counter-jib, a horizontal platform which holds the ballast, a counterweight stopping the crane from tipping over. This ballast is often a group of bound grey concrete slabs, looking a bit like immense stacked books. To one side, and at the top of the main mast, level with the slewing rig, is a small cabin, and here sits the person who operates the accurate navigations. His knees almost shoved up against a tinted sloping pane of glass, with his hands on the joysticks. He takes time to wave towards me, because I've been watching him for some time. He seems tiny, as if I could place him on the palm of my hand. There are some diagrams of cranes dating from ancient Greece. They were made from wood, and to my mind, their structure began as amplification of the movements our bodies do when we lift something heavy. I'm amazed that from two small contacts with the earth, the ball and heel of my foot, I have at my disposal a huge range of actions where each part of my body orchestrates itself to deal with the movements that I do every minute without thinking. I can walk, run, reach for something above my head, or pick something up from the floor. Despite its colossal scale, a crane has been engineered to undertake, like us, a sequence of adjustments in order to maintain its fragile equilibrium of opposing forces: weight, gravity, height, distance. When I reach forward to pick up a child, for example, I bend my knees, take my hips back, bringing my weight closer to the ground. This compensates for the trunk of my body being further forward than my normal weight distribution could tolerate, and stops me toppling while I adjust to taking on the weight of the child. I have to then readjust, moment by moment, as I stand straight with the child clasped to me. The tower crane's base is not free. Instead, it is bolted down into a concrete pad for extra stability. Above, depending on the weight of the load and the distance it has to travel, all sorts of adjustments need to be made. The distance between the load on the ground and using the crane in its most stable position needs to be finely tuned. The angles between the jib and the mast have to be precise. With the load close to the mast, where the crane is most stable, the cranes at King's Cross can carry a cargo equivalent to about six cars, almost 300 times heavier than can be lifted by any one of us. Once the hook is coaxed down from the sky to connect with the load, slowly, smoothly, the jib simultaneously rises and rotates. The load at the bottom of a long, almighty chain takes off, swinging up and round in a diagonal arc, dragging slightly as if through water. This unimaginable weight now seems to float, weightless, buoyed up by the viscous air. When it's eventually been lowered to the exact target, with heart-stopping accuracy, the hook is released and the chain swings hypnotically from side to side like a pendulum, each swing setting off a compensatory ripple in the opposite direction, higher up. Sometimes the whole crane sways, its flexible framework allowing it to bend without shattering. The delicate movements necessary to manoeuvre the hook are choreographed by the aerial operator and his earthbound banksman with hand signals and radio. In order to carry out a single task safely, particularly when the drag of the air pulls on the load as it moves more horizontally than vertically, the two men must allow for this delayed effect. They have to think about the whole trajectory of the action they are about to undertake. It is not so different for a dancer or an athlete who need to think of the consequences that each part of their movement has on the next, and then the next, and so on until the end of a phrase is reached. There is a strange contrary energy. The thrust of everything the crane does is ultimately directed upwards. They need to raise and position every single item needed in the construction of a building as it inches its way up from its foundations. Girders, concrete, piping, wires, sheets of glass are all seen dangling in the air on their way up. But at the same time, all the power of each crane is focused downward to a single point, the hook and the loads. When we see the height of a dancer's jump, we forget how much they have had to use the ground they spring from. Surprisingly, apart from the occasional metallic clunk and low-pitched whir, the cranes work in silence. There is a real sense of necessary calm and attention. I watch cranes at work with my dancer's and choreographer's eye. Something about the enormous moves undertaken by them make me feel something quite deep in my own body. The loads on the cranes dip and arc, rotating both left and right, and the distances between them contract and expand. It can feel like the transformation of a stage when huge scenery is moved, or entering an enormous art installation. Cranes are the first structures that warn us about the arrival of a new building, but they have also been used outside their normal role and become part of a wider story. I remember as a young woman standing on the banks of the Thames, watching Winston Churchill's body being carried on a launch. As the launch passed Hayes Wharf, each crane dipped. It was a massive and a tender gesture. And at Christmas time, I can look up and see fairy lights arranged on their tops, occasionally next to an isolated Christmas tree. There feels as if there is a particular relationship between these engineered beauties and the people who work them. I can go a long time without noticing cranes, and then I do, and I can't help but be drawn to the very edge of where they are at work and experience again that slight physical shift as I watch how they move.
And thanks to Siobhan Davis there. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, here from TNF Soundings is a list of audio-described programmes available on television, courtesy of our friends at the Wharfdale Talking Newspaper.
Hello, this is Diane from Wharfdale Talking News with Val's selection of audio-described TV programmes starting Saturday 6th to Friday 12th of July 2024. Live coverage of the European Football Championship and Wimbledon continues to cause some disruption to the usual schedules on BBC One, BBC Two and ITV One. Unfortunately, this also limits the usual variety of programmes available. However, let's see what we can find that might interest you, starting with Saturday, 6th of July. Mary Berry explores the Jurassic Coast and shares recipes inspired by the sea in Mary Berry Cook and Share on BBC One at 11:30 a.m. Ainsley is joined by chefs Daniel Galmiche and Ruby Bogal in Ainsley's National Trust Cook-Off at 11:40 a.m. on ITV One. Today's coverage of Wimbledon starts at 11 a.m. on BBC Two and continues throughout the week from around 1 p.m. Although not audio described, the commentary should give you a good idea of the action. If you want to escape the sport, there is a double bill of Midsummer Murders starting at 4 p.m. on ITV3. In the first episode, the arrival of the circus in town has deadly consequences. The second episode follows at 6 p.m. A choice of two films this evening, starting with a comedy drama. Following the death of its editor, a respected American magazine publishes one final issue comprising four of its classic articles. The French Dispatch is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. The second film stars Ethan Hawke as an LAPD rookie sent on a ride-along with swaggering narcotics cop Denzel Washington, who turns out to consider himself to be above the law. Training Day is on BBC One at 10:30 p.m. Now on to Sunday, 7th of July. Sunday with Laura Kunzberg, featuring interviews with politicians and key public figures, is on BBC One at 9 a.m. Bond goes in search of a solar energy device stolen by professional killer Scaramanga in the spy adventure The Man with the Golden Gun on ITV One at 3:25 p.m. Although not audio described, if you're an opera fan, you're in for a treat as it's Pavarotti Night on BBC Four from 7 to 11:45 p.m. This includes Pavarotti in Hyde Park at 8:25, the outdoor concert from 1991. It's the semi-final and the four remaining teams are challenged to make a modern version of the Peach Melba on Bake Off The Professionals, Channel 4, 8 p.m. A new eight-part crime drama series starts tonight, based on the books of Barbara Nadel. British police detective Mehmet Suleiman arrives in Istanbul to join the homicide unit led by eccentric Inspector Ickman as they investigate the murder of a university student. The Turkish Detective is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. and continues tomorrow at the same time. In the most ambitious engineering project he has ever been involved in, Guy sets out to help recover a crashed World War II Lancaster bomber and the remains of its missing crew members from a Dutch lake. Guy Martin's Lost World War II Bomber is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. Here are those programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. Starting with the soaps, EastEnders is on BBC Two at 7:30 p.m. on Monday, then back to BBC One for the rest of the week at 7:30, Tuesday and Wednesday, and at 8:15 on Thursday. Emmerdale is on ITV at 7:30 p.m. Monday to Friday. Coronation Street is on ITV at 8 p.m. Monday to Wednesday. However, all the soaps listed for Tuesday and Wednesday are subject to there being no football coverage on those specific channels on those days. On BBC One, Homes Under the Hammer is at 10:45 a.m. Tuesday to Thursday, but 11:15 Monday and Friday. Bargain Hunt is at 11:45 Tuesday to Thursday and 12:15 on Friday. Cooking with the Stars is on ITV One at 2 p.m. Monday to Wednesday. There are two episodes of Heartbeat on ITV Three at 6 p.m. and 7 p.m. Monday to Friday. Although not audio described, if you're a cycling fan, you can follow the daily highlights of the Tour de France at 7 p.m. Saturday to Friday on ITV4. Let's see what's on offer for Monday, 8th of July. It's the climax of the patisserie contest and the three remaining teams will have to pour all their passion and expertise into two epic challenges. Bake Off The Professionals, the final, is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. While the team closes in on a suspect, Suleiman pursues a private investigation on the side and unearths a mysterious name that he believes could be linked to something Leyla had discovered before her fateful accident. The second episode of The Turkish Detective is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. Davina McCall and Nikki Campbell return to follow more people as they search for their birth families in a new series of Long Lost Family on ITV One at 9 p.m. Having spent 4 years surveying and mapping every monument at Stonehenge, scientists in this documentary reveal new evidence about its origins. Operation Stonehenge, What Lies Beneath, is on BBC Four at 9 p.m. The comedy drama, loosely based on the life of Catherine the Great, returns for a final series. Chaotic events leave Catherine and Peter seeking marriage guidance. The Great is on Channel 4 at 10 p.m, the second episode following at 10 past 11. Now for Tuesday, 9th of July. K Kevin McLeod revisits a couple who set out to transform an old derelict cow shed into an off-grid small holding. Grand Designs is on Moor 4 at 7:55pm. In Torquay, harbour master Nick prepares to receive the world's largest residential cruise ship, whilst fisherman Stephen is limbering up for the lucrative Clovely Lobster Festival, Devon and Cornwall, in summer, is on Channel 4 at 8pm. It's Diva Week for the remaining sewers. The Great British Sewing Bee is on BBC One at 9pm, subject again to there being no football, in which case it will be shown at the same time tomorrow. On the coast of Northwest Ireland, the Bundoran crew race to the rescue of a teenage girl who has been swept out to sea by a rip current. Saving Lives at Sea is on BBC One at 9pm. On to Wednesday, July 10th. Struggling sportsman Buck Mitchell turns to Homer and Marge for marital advice in The Simpsons on Channel 4 at 6:30pm. Greg Wallace pays a visit to the Vale of Mowbray factory in North Yorkshire, which started making pork pies in 1928. Inside the Factory is on BBC Two at 9pm. Duncan and Liz plan to build a groundbreaking eco-home that will produce four times the energy it needs. Almost inevitably, their 18-month schedule spirals out of control and living apart takes its toll. Find out how they get on in Grand Designs on Channel 4 at 9pm. Now for Thursday, 11th of July. Toy Poodle Monty has been left with a damaged hip joint after a larger dog jumped on top of him, and his owners are hoping Noel can help. The super vet, Noel Fitzpatrick, is on Channel 4 at 8pm. The chef is in the Pennines on the hunt for the best of British beef and travels over to Lancashire to visit one of the country's biggest tomato producers. Tom Kerridge, Cooks Britain, is on ITV1 at 8:30pm. Another new six-part drama series starts tonight, based on the novel by Holly Jackson. For her school research project during the summer holidays, Pip looks into the disappearance of teenager Andy Bell, who was supposedly murdered by her boyfriend 5 years ago. A Good Girl's Guide to Murder is on BBC One at 9pm. The second episode is after the news at 10:40pm. When Douglas and Madeline first met each other, the encounter took an unexpected turn. Now, 3 years on, there are explosive consequences. The comedy drama Douglas is Cancelled is on ITV One at 9pm. A couple attempt to combine an army lorry and an old caravan to create the ultimate off-roader in George Clark's Amazing Spaces on Channel 4 at 9pm. And so, finally, to Friday, 12th of July. A programme following the work of the Lake District Mountain Rescue Association. From paragliders crashing into the mountains to scramblers who have fallen down waterfalls, the volunteers will drop everything to bring home the lost, injured and stricken. Lake District Rescue is on Channel 4 at 8pm. Another chance to watch Ben showing off his survival skills on a winter camping trip with Dad Pete in this episode of the comedy Outnumbered on BBC One at 8:30pm. More famous faces cast their eyes over the week's TV in Celebrity Gogglebox on Channel 4 at 9pm. Great Slaughter Cricket Club's star player is murdered in tonight's episode of Sister Boniface Mysteries on the Drama Channel at 9pm. And how about ending the week with a visit to the Caribbean? DI Jack Mooney and the team ride into another mystery when a competitor in a cycling race is found dead halfway around the course. Death in Paradise is on BBC One at 9pm.
More music now, and here is the full-length version of Hotter Than Hot by local composer Gothby. Now a piece from TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Jan with some seasonal tips and ideas from the gardening expert at the MK Pulse magazine, based in Milton Keynes. A blooming great show. Following months of digging, planting, potting and planning, the fruits of all those gardening labours are paying off. And if your garden is anything like the large allotment space being worked by Jean Cocker, you'll be reaping the rewards with a colourful show to lift the spirits. There are lots of flowers blooming just now, she told Pulse. There are so many to enjoy. Lobelias, pansies, petunias, mallows, foxgloves, hollyhocks, marigolds, stocks and aubrietia are leading the way. Jean is a slave to her open space and is often out early enough to enjoy the birdsong and see those flowers awakening from their slumber and turning towards the sun. A member of Conyborough's Larkspur Avenue, Jean has transformed her patch from an overgrown plot into a welcoming, cheery space to lift the mood. And the scent in the evening is gorgeous, she promises. Gardening novices might look at Jean's efforts and be overwhelmed, but she says that you should start small and don't be fazed when things go wrong, as some inevitably will. It's all a learning curve. And just like those stems that are the objects of desire, as your knowledge grows, so too will they. Mallows are always easy to grow, Jean promises. The seeds soon germinate and they also self-seed. My personal favourites are foxgloves, and I have lots of those on the allotment. If you want to garden but really feel at a loss, start by planting some flowers in pots, which makes gardening very easy, and even a little window box with lots of colours can make a big difference. The satisfaction of being able to sit back and say, I did that, is quite something, and of course you'll be bitten by the bug. Speaking of garden irritators, you'll need to work to bug-proof your seedlings and plants as much as possible. But no matter how good you are, you should expect some casualties. Marigolds provide a perfectly bright pop of orange and yellow, with their carnation-like flower heads also standing strong against incredibly hot temperatures. Planting close to tomatoes, especially if greenhouse grown, is worthwhile. They make the perfect companion flower as they deter whiteflies. They can be tricky when grown outside because we aren't the only ones that love them. The slugs do too, Jean said, speaking from experience. Being on the allotment gives me such a feeling of well-being. It gives me a great sense of achievement. And at this time of year especially, I can't wait to get out of bed and get down there. It's food for the soul, and I really would advise anyone to give it a go. The difference it makes to mind, spirit and body is really something. So, how does your garden grow? The holiday season approaches. The rate of growth of all the plants in the garden is increasing. The squashes, melons and pumpkins have grown well, as have the tomatoes in growing bags and the chilies in large pots. All need regular feeding using a high potash tomato fertiliser. It is important to use the correct dilution, preferably in rainwater, applied to the compost or soil around each plant without splashing the foliage. The first early and second early potatoes have all grown well in large pots, topped up with acquired loam, and some have been harvested with great results. Early sown sweet peas are flowering well. Picking the flowers daily inhibits seed pod production and encourages more flowers. They too need watering and feeding regularly. Remember the mantra, feed on Friday. Last month, we mulched round the strawberry plants with straw, and they have rewarded us handsomely. The collection of large terracotta pots in which we had a wonderful display of spring tulips have been emptied, and the bulbs dried and stored. They are refilled with container compost and planted with bedding plants, including impatiens, pansies, lobelia, bacopa, petunias, and pelargoniums, amongst others. The compost heap, piled within three pallets set at right angles, has been dug out. The coarse material on top, which has not rotted down, has been heaped on top of the logs of a hedgehog's den. The rest of the decomposed material was used to mulch the decorative shrubs around the sitting area. We all need a rest.
TNF Soundings.
No entertainment and events roundup from Peter Burley this week. He's taking a well-earned summer break. New York City, like London, has wonderful buildings and especially monuments. Here, James Molinero, president of the borough of Staten Island, describes the 9/11 memorial.
Hello, I'm James Molinero, president of the borough of Staten Island. The 9/11 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center hit Staten Island especially hard. 275 Staten Island residents died when the towers went down. I felt that Staten Island needed its own memorial, a place for the loved ones of the victims to mourn and reflect, and a place for all visitors to remember those who lost their lives in that tragic day. I commissioned the artist and architect Masuki Sono to create a fitting memorial. The result is a sculpture called Postcards, and I'm happy to describe it for you. It's located on the north shore of the island, a short walk from the Staten Island Ferry Terminal. In fact, you can see the memorial from the ferry as it approaches Staten Island from Manhattan. In essence, postcards consist of two walls that face each other like two postcards standing on their ends. They are white and constructed of a fiberglass material. They are 40 feet tall and stand about 8 feet apart. You can say the twin postcards imitate the twin towers of the Trade Center, but they don't stand tall and straight like the towers. Instead, the artist has softly bent the upper edges of the walls outward, transforming simple rectangulars into an abstract form. Some people think they look like two curving wings forming a gentle V. Other people think of sails or flower petals, and still others think they look like pages of a book turning to a new chapter of life. The architect says he chose the design so that the visitors can interpret the walls in ways that they feel best for them. To get a better sense of their design, imagine you have two postcards on a table in front of you. You hold them vertically with your hands and top edges of the cards. Stand the bottom edges on a table a few inches apart so that they face each other. Angle them out a bit so that the corners closest to you are closer together. Now, keeping the bottoms of the cards on the table, lean the tops of the cards away from each other a bit and bend the tops of the cards out and away from each other so that there's a slight curve in the cards. Those shapes, in essence, are the sculpture's postcards. Sono chose this design because he felt that even in the high-tech era of cell phones and email, the postcard continues to be a personal handwritten communication sent across great distance. Sono liked that postcards are a simple way to send messages of love and remembrance. The two white walls are positioned on the St. George Esplanade, a wide open plaza that's paved with red bricks. If you stand between the walls and face north, you are looking directly across the harbor at Lower Manhattan and the spot where the Twin Towers stood. But the two walls are not solid slabs. To preserve individual memories of the people who died, Sonra designed six rows of rectangular boxes into the two walls that face each other. Each rectangle is 9 by 11 inches, about the size of a sheet of photocopy paper. Each rectangle contains a profile of the face of a person who died in the terrorist attack September 11, 2001, along with the person's name, birth date, and where the person worked. There are 263 profiles on the memorial, and as the sun strikes each profile, it casts the shadow of the profile behind it into a recessed box. At night, spotlights at the base of the wall substitute for the sun, so both day and night lights and shadows bring the memorial and its profiles to life. If you visit the memorial, feel free to touch the profiles of the people. I am extremely proud that Staten Island has such a beautiful and moving tribute to the victims of 9/11. Our children and grandchildren will be able to come and look at it and think about the heroism and tragic loss of life on that awful day. I encourage you to visit the memorial on your next trip to Staten Island.
Before I wrap up with the week in history and birth dates, here's another item from TNF Soundings.
Hello, this is Amanda with an article written by Fiona about a Be Helpful guide launched by RNIB, the Royal National Institute of Blind People. New research done on behalf of RNIB reveals that almost 9 in every 10 blind or partially sighted people may need some help when they're making an unfamiliar journey. Information on the RNIB website also reveals that many sighted people feel confident they know the signs that a blind or partially sighted person needs assistance, but say they often feel nervous or awkward about offering help. Now RNIB have launched their Be Helpful guide, offering tips and advice aimed at encouraging sighted people to offer a helping hand or voice, rather than waiting to be asked. People with visual impairments told researchers that they would like sighted people to offer assistance at train stations and bus stops. A third of people said assistance would also be welcome when on a pavement with obstacles, such as bins, pavement parking, or approaching scooters. Researchers also asked, what are the main things people forget to do when trying to guide you? The results of this were quite revealing, with many sighted people forgetting to give verbal directions or introduce themselves. Almost a third of respondents said that people forget to talk to me directly and not my companion or guide dog, and almost a quarter said that people forget to say goodbye. The RNIB are running a campaign to promote their new guide, supported by a series of TV films featuring actors with sight loss. The campaign uses everyday, relatable experiences including navigating A-boards on the high street, waiting for a bus, dodging cars parked on pavements, bumping into unexpected bins, and attempting to locate milk at the local shop. Actor Kelsey Ellison stars in one of the short films. Kelsey, who has a prosthetic eye, said, RNIB's campaign and making the film struck a chord with me. I experience these challenges all the time, bumping into A-boards outside cafes and battling with overhanging branches. It might seem like a small thing, but if people take the time to say hello and offer assistance to people with sight loss, or move an A-board or bin, it makes a huge difference. David Aldwinkle, RNIB's Director of Insight and Customer Voice, said, whilst most people with sight loss like me have worked out ways to get around as independently as we can, that doesn't mean help isn't welcome. When somebody asks me at the bus stop if I need any help, I really appreciate it. Just that small recognition that help might be useful makes me feel like I belong and am part of the community. There are times when help is really important. When walking through a busy and crowded underground station, you sometimes have to guess which is the right way to go, which raises feelings of anxiety. A quick hello and question of, do you need a hand, means I can ask if I'm going the right way, and it makes such a difference. If you would like to help people with sight loss get around more easily, get RNIB's top tips on how you can be helpful. Go to www.rnib.org.uk and search Be Helpful Guide to find out more.
TNF Soundings.
Hello, my name is Lindsay. I started producing topical items during lockdown to keep my neighbours entertained. All the recordings are made inside my cosy cabin for that extra sense of calm. And naturally enough, I called them Cabin Conversations. I hope you enjoy them. Cabin Conversations about Coast Guard Day. The 4th of August commemorates the anniversary of the founding of the US Coast Guard by Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton in 1790. Originally called the Revenue Marine because their remit was to serve as an armed customs enforcement service. In 1894, it was renamed the Revenue Cutter Service, and in 1915, it merged with the US Lifesaving Service. Thus, the United States Coast Guard was formed as the principal federal agency responsible for maritime safety, security, and environmental stewardship in US ports and waterways. The Coast Guard are one of the five armed services and part of the intelligence community of the United States, and the only military branch within the Department of Homeland Security. In addition to its role as an armed service, the Coast Guard is a first responder and humanitarian service that provides aid to people in distress or impacted by natural and human-made disasters, whether at sea or ashore. They are also associated with maritime transportation, hazardous material shipping, bridge administration, oil spill response, pilotage, and vessel construction and operation. Coast Guard units of past and present personnel across America organise picnics and sport competitions to celebrate Coast Guard's Day. The UK Coast Guard began later than the United States, starting with the Preventative Water Guard in 1809. Their small force was specifically tasked only with stopping smuggling, a very lucrative and violent illegal profession. They would go around patrolling all the bays and coves by boat. This was the initial priority because of the country's economic and security fears brought about by the smugglers undermining legal revenue. An ever-growing problem since medieval times, when taxes started being charged on imports and exports. Her Majesty's Coast Guard was formed on the 15th of January 1822, and by 1829 the HM Coast Guard were covering patrols for smuggling and assisting with shipwrecks, mostly to stop looting opportunities, but also carrying out basic life-saving duties at sea. Then the service seemed to change hands a lot between the Board of Customs, the Board of Trade, the Treasury, and the Royal Navy for many years. Their remit widened further in the 1960s, when a major sea oil pollution incident became a highlighted concern, reshaping the search and rescue side to cover oil and gas sea-based industries. The equipment and facilities over time also became enhanced, with visual warning stations changing to radio warning stations, all-terrain vehicles, better boats, and the introduction of helicopters, etc. Finally, in 1998, the Marine Safety Agency and the Coast Guard Agency were joined together into the service we know today. This combined Maritime and Coast Guard Agency exists to promote the high standards of safety at sea, to minimise loss of life amongst seafarers and coastal users, to protect the environment by minimising pollution from ships, and to respond to maritime emergencies 24 hours a day. The 200th anniversary celebration of the UK service took place in 2022, and Coast Guards across all four home nations cast throw lines as a symbol of dedication to both the past and the present. The present, of course, particularly since the merge of agencies, has allowed Coast Guards to focus on introducing more advanced and assistive technology, which means the UK Maritime and Coast Guard Agency has become the best model for search and rescue coordination worldwide. May you always find the calm in the storm.
And finally, courtesy of Wendy at Stevenage Talking Newspapers, here are some notable events that have taken place in the upcoming week. On the 7th of July 2005, a series of four coordinated suicide attacks carried out by Islamic terrorists targeted commuters travelling on London's public transport during the morning rush hour. Three terrorists separately detonated three homemade bombs in quick succession aboard London Underground trains in Inner London. Later, a fourth terrorist detonated another bomb on a double-decker bus in Tavistock Square. Apart from the bombers, 52 UK residents of 18 different nationalities were killed, and more than 700 were injured in the attacks. The bombings were followed 2 weeks later by a series of attempted attacks that failed to cause injury or damage. On the 8th of July 1965, Great Train Robber Ronnie Biggs escaped from Wandsworth Prison after serving 15 months of his prison sentence. He scaled the wall with a rope ladder and dropped onto a waiting removal van. He fled to Brussels by boat before sending a note to his wife to join him in Paris, where he had acquired new identity papers and was undergoing plastic surgery. He subsequently became notorious for his escape from prison, living as a fugitive for 36 years, and for his various publicity stunts while in exile. In 2001, Biggs returned to the United Kingdom and spent several years in prison, where his health rapidly declined. He was released from prison on compassionate grounds in August 2009 and died in a nursing home in December 2013. On the 9th of July 1762, Catherine the Great assumed power after overthrowing her husband, Peter III. Under her long reign, inspired by the ideas of the Enlightenment, Russia experienced a renaissance of culture and sciences, which led to the founding of many new cities, universities, and theatres, along with large-scale immigration from the rest of Europe, and with the recognition of Russia as one of the great powers of Europe. She reigned as Empress of Russia for 34 years. On the 10th of July 1962, the communications satellite Telstar 1 was launched by NASA. It was the satellite that allowed the first live broadcast of television images between the United States and Europe. Telstar 1 remained active for only 7 months before it prematurely failed due to Starfish Prime, a high-altitude nuclear test conducted by the US. Although the satellite is no longer operational, it remains in Earth orbit. On the 11th of July 1804, a duel between two leading American politicians, Vice President Aaron Burr and former Secretary of the Treasury Alexander Hamilton, resulted in the death of Hamilton in hospital the following day. The duel was the culmination of a bitter rivalry that had developed over years between the two men, who were high-profile politicians in the newly established United States. The duel ended Burr's political career as he was vilified for shooting Hamilton. On the 12th of July 2013, on her 16th birthday, Malala Yousafzai addressed the UN calling for worldwide access to education. From a young age, she had spoken out publicly in support of girls' right to learn. And in October the previous year, she had been shot in the head by a Taliban gunman in retaliation for her activism. She was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2014 and went on to study philosophy, politics, and economics at the University of Oxford, graduating in 2020. She continues to campaign for girls' access to education. On the 13th of July 1955, Ruth Ellis became the last woman to be executed in the United Kingdom following the fatal shooting of her lover, David Blakely. In her teens, Ellis had entered the world of nightclub hostessing, which led to a chaotic life that included various relationships with men. One of these men was David Blakely, a racing driver engaged to another woman. On Easter Sunday, 10th of April 1955, Ellis shot Blakely dead outside the Magdala Public House in Hampstead, London. She was immediately arrested by an off-duty policeman. At her trial in June 1955, she was found guilty of premeditated murder and was sentenced to death. And on July the 13th, she was hanged at Holloway Prison. And now, courtesy of Bob at Stevenage Talking Newspapers, famous birthdays. July the 7th. Richard Starkey is the English musician, songwriter and actor, better known as Ringo Starr. Born in inner city Liverpool in 1940, he is most famous as the drummer in the Beatles, whom he joined in 1962, replacing the original drummer. but he has also had success as a solo musician, actor, and as the narrator of the first two series of the children's television programme Thomas and Friends. He was knighted in the 2018 New Year's Honours List for services to music. July the 8th. Born in 1831 in Knoxville, Georgia, John Stith Pemberton is a name probably better known in the USA than the UK, but his famous invention is recognised worldwide. Pemberton was a pharmacist and Confederate States Army veteran. After his efforts to control his chronic pain from a sabre wound received in the American Civil War led to morphine addiction, Pemberton set about searching for an alternative. He developed a beverage blending alcohol and cocaine, which he called Pemberton's French Wine Coca. Pemberton made many health claims for his product, touting it as a valuable brain tonic that would cure headaches, relieve exhaustion, and calm nerves, and marketed it as delicious and invigorating. With public concern about drug addiction, depression, and alcoholism amongst war veterans, and neurasthenia amongst highly strung southern women, Pemberton's medicine was advertised as particularly beneficial for ladies and all those whose sedentary employment causes nervous prostration. But temperance legislation meant Pemberton had to produce a non-alcoholic alternative, which would become known as Coca-Cola. July the 9th, Yorkshireman David Hockney is an English painter, printmaker, stage designer and photographer, born in 1937. He has owned residences and studios in Bridlington and London, as well as in America. As an important contributor to the pop art movement of the 1960s, he is considered one of the most influential British artists of the 20th and 21st centuries. In 2018, Hockney's 1972 work Portrait of an Artist, Pool with Two Figures, sold at Christie's auction in New York City for $90 million, £70 million, becoming the most expensive artwork by a living artist sold at auction. That record remained until 2019. July the 10th. Sunil Gavaskar is a former captain of the Indian national cricket team who represented India and Bombay from 1971 to 1987. Now aged 75, Gavaskar is acknowledged as one of the greatest opening batsmen of all time, particularly admired for his technique against fast bowling. Under his captaincy, the Indian team was considered as one of the first attacking ones, winning the 1984 Asia Cup and the World Championship of Cricket in 1985. Gavaskar played 125 Test matches for India and was the first player ever to score more than 10,000 Test runs. He is a recipient of numerous sporting awards, including a Lifetime Achievement Award, the highest honour the Indian Cricket Board of Control can bestow on a former player. July the 11th. Reg Varney was an English actor, entertainer and comedian born in Canning Town in London in 1916. Having performed as a music hall entertainer, Varney first came to national recognition as factory foreman Reg Turner in the sitcom The Rag Trade, but is best remembered for having played the lead role of bus driver Stan Butler in the sitcom On the Buses from 1969 to 1973 and its three spin-off feature films. He appeared in further sitcoms including Beggar My Neighbour, and his On the Buses stardom facilitated overseas cabaret tours. July the 12th. Louis B. Mayer was a Canadian-American film producer and co-founder of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios in 1924. Under Mayer's management, MGM became the film industry's most prestigious movie studio, accumulating the largest concentration of leading writers, directors and stars in Hollywood. Mayer claimed to believe in wholesome entertainment and went to great lengths to discover new actors and develop them into major stars, but was controversial for his treatment of the actors under his management during his long reign at MGM. Some saw him as a concerned father figure, while others did not appreciate his attempts to control their private lives, demanding compliance from female stars by threatening their livelihoods. This was the case, for example, for Judy Garland, whom he forced to go on diets, take drugs, and work punishing schedules. July the 13th. Born in 1960 in Swansea, Ian Hislop is a British journalist, satirist, and television personality. He is the editor of the satirical magazine Private Eye, a position he has held since 1986. He has appeared on numerous radio and television programmes and has been a team captain on the BBC satirical quiz show Have I Got News For You since its inception in 1990. Hislop has been involved in numerous legal battles, as Private Eye has often been sued for libel over the years. Despite these challenges, Hislop has remained a key figure in British satire and journalism.
And that finishes up this edition of Primary. My thanks to David, Christine, Keith, Andy, Jane and Deborah for reading the news, to Gilly for reading the radio listings, and thanks also to Siobhan Davis and James Molinero, and all at TNF Soundings. Primary will be back in 4 weeks' time. Let me take this opportunity to wish you a safe, peaceful and hopefully sunny July. Please remember to return your USB stick and wallet after use, and please stay well and safe at home. Goodbye.